You're listening to the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirk Wood Bromley.
All right, so welcome. This is episode 2 of my conversations with Daniel Martin Berkey, the actor. For whom I wrote Remission and who performed Remission, both on stage and in the audiobook version. My last chat with Dan, we basically talked about the genesis of the work. And in this one, we walk through the work a little more than halfway, so there's going to be one more episode. Basically just talking through the moments in the play, the scenes as they are, and the experiences that those scenes are based on. By and large, the play is autobiographical, if you can say that about something like this kind of play. The text was the result of many conversations that Dan and I had. And I grabbed things from his real life, and I crystallized them into this text. So I chat with Dan about those real-life experiences, and I also get his comments on what it was like to perform that stuff, any takes he has on what the play says, any dissonances he experienced between the play and his actual cognition and emotions and memories. And just trying to get some cool behind-the-scenes thoughts from him about absorbing and performing the play and having it regurgitate many of his darker and more difficult remembrances. So here it is, Dan and I walking through the first half of his performance and experience with the play based on his journey through and out of schizophrenia remission.
All right, so we're recording. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm very good, Kirk. Very good.
Good, good. So this is our second. This is our second little session together. And as I said in the first one, I wanted to spend this one and probably the next one talking through specific sections of the play and getting your input on what's going on there in that section, what you think about topics raised in the section, and maybe even some. Hearing a bit from you about the real life experiences that led to what's depicted in the section. So I'm going to start by asking you a question that relates to some of the lines you say near the beginning of the play. And those lines are, my name is Daniel Martin Berkey, and I am a post-schizophrenic actor. To knack this knurled newt, let us look at said epithet, or is it epitaph, composed of three hostile collaborative terms, post, schizophrenic, actor. So I think what I want to ask you is, and it's a big, big question, but I think you're always good at parsing these things down. What is it to be schizophrenic? What is it to be post-schizophrenic? And what is it like to be a schizophrenic or a post-schizophrenic actor, as opposed to anything else? So that's my question. Why don't you go ahead and start?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Let me think about that. There's a line in the first section. Well, first of all, I'm going to say that every section I found something to anchor it. I'm not ignoring a question.
Sure.
But I found something in each section to anchor it for me. So I would have a place to start. And funny thing, I can't think of the line right now. I lost it. But it basically says, what I think of myself is not what other people think of me. Or what I say is not what other people say of me. And I wish I could find the exact line, but it's about no matter how normal you are, let's say there's a normality, there's no schizophrenic condition, the mind is not disordered, yet you still have all these senses, including your eyes, that you perceive the world. And you perceive the world according to you. Your eyes see what your eyes see, truly, uniquely, idiosyncratically you. And you can have somebody stand right next to you and talk about something, and you can talk about the something that has a physical form, and you have agreement on the physical form. But what he sees, what you see, are two totally different things, even though you call it the same thing. And speaking about me, what I say about me is not what other people say about me, or what other people will ever think about me. And even what I see of myself in a mirror is not who I am really. Physically, even physically, I'm just seeing light bouncing off this face that I call Nan Burgess. I'm not seeing my face. I'm seeing light that's bouncing off of it. So everything's in hearsay. Everything. And so the further you go into the schizophrenic condition, where it becomes more confused, and your existence is on this wild shifting plate tectonics, you just don't know where you are sometimes, you can't even reference yourself at any one particular point. And you want to. At some point, you want to be the center of the universe, because you have to figure somehow that you are the center of your awareness, and everybody else has to perceive you where you are. And you perceive you where you are. But in the schizophrenic condition, you're never where you are. You're always someplace else. And I know that's really general and very vague and rather cryptic, but it is very close to it. And damn.
Let me read the line I think that you're talking about, okay?
Okay.
It says, well, I'm going to try to figure out where to start. I'm going to start here. I say, allow me to magnify my vagaries as having said the very thing I shouldn't have said, for once it's said, what else is there to say? Which is much less than to say what you get is what you see, and what you see is what you don't get, hopefully won't get, because you don't want it, being as you already have it. It's just not there for the having.
That's right. Exactly.
Especially not within this vague lamas of regenerating ruction, where we and superannuated immediate symbologies still strive to share what we don't have, which in the end, or in spite of the end, is really all we have for our ridiculous attempts. And here's where I think what you're talking about comes in, to be free of that mind-poaching chasm between what we say and what's said of us, right, which after everything's been left unsaid is the pulse of the schizophrenic corpse.
That, what I just talked about, is exactly what you just said in terms of that was what anchored the whole thing, and actually what anchored a lot of the whole presentation. And that really is at the core of what the schizophrenic condition is. And everything in actually, that whole first section actually repeats that same thing in different rhetoric, but essentially is saying the same thing about 10 times, that whole first section. I find that interesting and kind of funny. And somebody actually pointed that out to me when they saw it. They said, you know, I've been thinking about that first section. I was listening to it. And I was thinking, my God, he's just sort of repeating himself over and over again in different words. And he's right. And I noted it down. And this is the first time I wanted to relate it to you, because that's not a weakness in the writing by any means. It's actually, you can talk about the same thing in many different ways that other people won't recognize that, unless they're really attuned to a person's awareness.
So there's maybe it's pointing to a kind of obsessive, repetitive, compulsive looping of what's said and what's been said and what's said of us, what's said for us, what we're saying, what others are saying we're saying, and getting kind of stuck in that treadmill of semantic terror. Is that something you're saying?
Yeah, that's like nobody can agree on that, because there's no agreement. Because everybody has a different awareness. You have a different awareness. You know, I have a different awareness constantly in the schizophrenic condition. And you can't even take an inventory on yourself because there's no inventory to be taken because it's constantly, constantly morphing. It's changing too fast. It's like a very unstable atom in a nuclear reactor. You can't really keep up with it because it's constantly changing every millionth of a second. And that is great frustration. And that's something that I was very aware of during the condition. And I had to let that go. I interrupted you. What were you going to say?
No, please keep going with what you're saying.
Yeah. I had to keep on trying to anchor myself, whatever I could do to anchor myself. And this whole first section is to me all about anchoring and the impossibility of anchoring myself during that condition and the continual frustration of failed attempts. And finally, I would give up, and I would give up in terms of, this talks about other sections, of medicating myself with drugs, alcohol, with sex, with violence, whatever. I would try to medicate myself because I couldn't figure it out myself. My mind was too disordered. I just couldn't anchor myself with myself. So I made it worse by medicating myself. Now that's all another section. In other sections, it bleeds into that. But let's stay with this one section. And it's beautiful how much it repeats itself, but it repeats itself in a very beautiful way, that there's different colors in every repetition, talking about yourself and how the world sees you and how you see the world. And it's like giving your location of uninformed readiness. Yet none of this is really relevant to knowing what ready means in a place where knowing what ready means you're not ready.
Yeah.
So, ready?
So
you want to join this crazy cyclone roller coaster with me?
Yeah.
No, I don't want to get out of here. Yeah. And anybody who's really sane understands what they might be getting into. They don't want to go on that ride.
Yeah.
And then I follow it with touching them. I grab them. I put a hook on my line and say, okay, don't you dare think about leaving because I'm going to catch you now. I'm going to pull you in with this hook.
Yeah.
It's brilliantly constructed because if somebody is really listening, really taking that in, that whole first section, which I would think maybe 20% of the audience at best would, a lot of people are like tuning out. I could tell that no matter how specific I could be. Most of the people were like tuned out by this last part. And then it goes into something that's very straightforward and narrative about touching them, which is very clear. It's almost as clear as the latter sections of the play when I begin to talk in a very normal rhetoric or a rhetoric that a lot of people can understand or relate to. And this whole first section goes into so many different places, but the thing is, it's going in the same place all the time. The wheel is spinning and the car is not going anywhere. It's just spinning in the mud, trying to get out of the mud.
So if that state is schizophrenia, what is post-schizophrenia? What changes?
Being aware of being stuck in the mud. And when you are stuck in the mud, then you have a choice to get out of it. One of the things about the awareness of schizophrenia, it's given you many different pictures of reality, many different ways of looking at it. The funhouse mirrors. You've had the whole series of funhouse mirrors all your life. But now you know it's a funhouse, and you're out of that funhouse, but you can go back into that funhouse. It's like once you go through a terrible experience and you survive, you know what that experience is and you can communicate it in some fashion to another human being that's never been there and give them some idea of what it is. But they can only give them a glimpse because a lot of the experience of schizophrenia is ineffable. And there's no way you can throw words at it like people throw words at love and hate. You should never really try to hope some of those words stick. And this is what you've done with this beautiful play. You throw these words at it. But you go into this experience and you come out of it and you can point to certain funhouse mirrors and you can tell people, this is how I perceive the reality. But you also have to say, use the pronoun me. That is me, I, not you. How you would go through that funhouse is up to you. I don't have any idea what you're going to see in those mirrors, but those mirrors are there. And I'm going to tell you what I saw. It's like going through experience with the mob or going through experience with a lot of drug dealers. A lot of people don't know really what that is. They see a lot of movies about it, but they don't really know what it is. And when you talk to somebody who's really lived that life, it kind of sobers people up. They realize, gosh, I really had no idea what that really was.
So it sounds a little like you're saying that having schizophrenia is like being locked in a funhouse and post schizophrenia is like being able to walk in and out of the funhouse at will.
That's right.
Yeah, I like that. Now let's keep going with this idea. So you have been an actor who had schizophrenia or was schizophrenic, pre-release actor, a schizophrenic actor, and you've been a post-schizophrenic actor. And acting is a very specific, you know, act. It's a trade. It's a skill. It's a behavior. It's a praxis. So you've experienced being an actor, being on stage, memorizing lines, working with directors, developing characters, becoming someone you're not, portraying motives and intentions and thoughts that aren't necessarily yours, but making it seem as if they are. You've done that whole thing of being an actor, and you've done it as a schizophrenic person and as a non-schizophrenic person. Describe what those things are like, what it's like, how schizophrenia and acting interacted with each other.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that's very important, and it's something that really gets at the core of it. I could only answer that by saying that, which is also rather cryptic, is that one of the remedies that I found to stable myself, to anchor myself, it's very ironic, is to act. When I take on a part, when I learn lines that are not my own, and I pretend they are my own, the conditions of the noises in my head, the voice, so-called voices, which I want to talk about at some point, because they're not really voices, like you're talking to me or I'm talking to you, those kind of impacts are not impacting on me anymore. Because the lines that I have written, they take over what those other things were doing to me. And so the more I acted, the less the schizophrenic conditions impacted on me during the time when I was either rehearsing or performing. I can't explain that, but that's absolutely true. I think you touched on that a little bit in some of the later sections when you're talking about the process of acting, because it was a relief. It was a palliative. It was a way of medicating those conditions that spun me so out of control, where I just couldn't handle the simplest things in real life, like balancing a checkbook. I just couldn't do it sometimes. But when I was acting, pretending to be another person, everything stabilized. And I was no longer confused. As long as I focused in, maybe that's why, and I'm going to butt myself on the back a little bit, why I was so good at it, why I continue to be kind of good at it, is that if I throw myself completely into this role and be this other person, the schizophrenia will go away, which is what happened. The more I went into the character, the more I explored it, those symptoms would disappear. But then they come crashing back as soon as I left the stage door. So I became obsessed, addicted, you could say, in a way, to acting. I had to act in order to keep that shit away. That's pretty basically.
Yeah, well, you've pointed out that you stopped stage acting after remission. So, but you have you're doing film acting, and that is acting. Though, of course, some people will argue, but you know, sometimes you think like, I don't know, you think about a band, right? A band whose like albums and concerts were all done while they were on drugs. And then they quit drugs, and the music, the writing of the music, the performing of the music, it maybe changes, and maybe it becomes something different. Maybe it becomes less, maybe it becomes more, who knows, but it changes. Do you feel a difference in acting between when you were schizophrenic and when you were not?
No. No, no,
so it's still the same experience.
Yeah. When I was no longer facing the conditions of schizophrenia, it was a terrific feeling of relief in a way that I could. Let me put it this way. I would approach my acting post-schizophrenia in a more gentle way. It wasn't frantic, like I have to do this. Or like, okay, now I can shoot up, I have to drive, I can smoke, I can drink. It wasn't frantic. I didn't need a hit anymore. It was something that I did. And so, in a way, my acting became better because it was more relaxed. I could leave that pressure alone because the pressure was not there anymore. so I could explore whatever character was given me in a more relaxed fashion, no less dedicated to exploring the core of the character and finding that, what that really means for me. I was still dedicated to that, but given the fact that I was no longer having been assaulted by the Luftwaffe, I could now come up and take a breath of air without being feared I was going to be killed by an air-to-surface missile. This is an analogy. I know you know what I know what I mean.
Yeah, great.
And I was very relaxed, and I could relax from the acting, go home, and not be afraid that I was going to be assaulted, laying in bed because I'm not acting anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting because also, Josh Berg, who I wrote Syndrome for, saw a cessation of his symptoms, ticking in particular, when he was on stage. And I was first informed about his Tourette's before he went on stage, and I worked with him as an actor before I wrote Syndrome. He had this warm up that none of us really knew what it was about. And he used to stand in the corner backstage and kind of, he would sound like a gerbil eating wood, you know, and ticking and cursing and just ticking and cursing. And we thought it was just a warm up, but it turns out he would actually just kind of like spend 10 minutes getting all his ticks out. And then he would go on stage and he would be able to not tick while on stage. And in fact, he never did tick on stage. In the plays that I worked with him on, other than Syndrome. But in Syndrome, of course, he was encouraged to tick. But it's interesting that Josh recounted.
So the sections in Syndrome where he was ticking were written into the script. He wasn't really ticking.
That's right.
I thought he was ticking.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really remember him ticking beyond the ticking that was in the play, actually. So to his credit,
that's great because I can take control.
He ticked on script. He ticked on script, which I'm sure is, you know, not an easy challenge.
But to me, as you know, sometimes it took over during the script. That was one of the three fearsome things about schizophrenia, performing remission, is that we've talked about that briefly before, is that I was afraid that something might happen and I would have a decomposition in the middle of the performance. And there was never a decomposition, but I think the fear of the decomposition took over sometimes and confused me, and I lost my place. And I was colliding with myself, colliding with the fear of myself performing remission, thinking that a decomposition was going to happen that never happened. So I had to get through that, and sometimes it would just stop me. And we talked a little bit about that before, but anyway, I never had a decomposition in schizophrenia. I know I'm kind of changing the subject. I just wanted to say that it was never a decomposition.
That's good. So you never had one during remission or during any play you did before remission?
Oh, no, not in terms of the delusional behavior, the paranoia, the fear. That was all acting. What I'm talking about are those moments where I just stopped. It was like a collision with myself. I was more or less colliding with the fear of myself, having the fear and trying to get rid of the fear.
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is, like, say in all the plays you acted in before remission, when you had schizophrenia, did schizophrenia ever intrude itself into your mind when you were on stage to such a degree that you had to stop acting or things got really difficult or strange?
No. Actually, that's what I wanted to make very clear, is that when I was acting before, no matter how mundane it was, even if it was a Neil Simon play, the schizophrenic conditions would stop. That's why I loved it so much. It never intruded. So it's ironic that when I was doing remission about schizophrenia, I was afraid it would intrude.
Yeah.
Before, when I had the condition in my real daily life, I went to the acting, I went to the stage to get rid of it. I never told anybody about it. I never talked about it. But when I would be on stage, it never intruded, even when I was rehearsing.
Yeah, great. Okay, that's really fascinating. So let me move on. I want to move on to sort of after the whole intro of the play, where you talk quite a bit about schizophrenia, as you say, and this kind of looping obsessive manner. And you kind of, I would say, you both narrate aspects of having schizophrenia and display schizophrenic mentations in real time on stage. after all that, which I think lasts like some 15 minutes, and the touch scene, you say, but let us return to epigenesis with a taser on a homecoming float, soggy with now. To midge into this upcycling disaster, as I did, as we all may, through the frippage of two violent, conscientious egg masks, is much deplangentizing to the sage whose root is why he rhymes with plucked. So two violent, conscientious egg masks are, and I'll lay this out there for the literary analysts of the future, those are your parents. You midged into this upcycling disaster. You crawled into this life through the frippage or the fucking of two violent, conscientious egg masks. And I think violent and conscientious depict maybe not your mother and your father as juxtapositions of sweet or as vicious and sweet, but that there was a violent and yet conscientious aspect to them and the whole situation. It wasn't pure oppression, pure evil. So tell us about, we hear a lot about your parents in this play. Everything that's in there is from your telling me about your parents and what I garnered about them. And to be fair to their memories, what I turned them into for a fictional piece. But tell us about your parents.
Well, you would have pretty much captured it in a nutshell. There's a nut on show with regard to my parents. My mother was out of control for most of my youth. She only found control when she was in the kitchen. We never talked a little bit about that. I'm not even elaborated about the fact that my mother found stability because she was seriously disturbed. I don't know whether it was psychosis, schizophrenia, or whatever it was, but she would go off and she'd usually beat me up for spilling my soup with her winter goodness bowl. And that's very clear about is she would beat me up for absolutely no reason. So that can lead a person to a rather dissociative condition, trying to get away from that sort of thing. But my mother found terrific stability in the kitchen. Now, I find a great deal of stability in my own life by cooking. Both my parents cooked, but my mother particularly. But she would be in the kitchen, and she would be perfectly fine. She wouldn't go off. She wouldn't be screaming. She wouldn't do anything. She wouldn't throw knives around, which sometimes I was a little afraid of. She would be perfectly sane and normal. But as soon as she came out of the kitchen and did something else, she would go completely batshit crazy. She would start screaming at my father. My father would go down to his shop in the basement and work on some of his cabinets. He was very good at making some cabinets. He never sold them. He just sort of gave them away. But they were very nice cabinets, handmade. That was his way of escaping my mother's craziness. I had no escape, really. And so my father had a good heart, but he was weak. He had a good mind, and I'm not going to disparage him so much, but he was a weak man. He wasn't very smart, but he had a good heart. He tried very hard to do the best for me and for best for mother, but he was ill-equipped. He was too far over his head. He just didn't know how to handle it. So he handled it in his own way by working downstairs on those cabinets and dressers and various wooden creations that he loved to do so much in a very simple shop. When my mother would be railing off her nut upstairs and throwing things around, I don't know how many plates were broken. She would just start breaking plates sometimes in the dining room, not when she was cooking. She'd go and break some plates. She wouldn't break just all of them. She would just break two or three. She'd just smash them against the wall or the floor. Now, my mother was very unhappy. She shouldn't have been there. As I know my mother now and what she should have been, she should not have been what she was. Therefore, I never would have been born if she followed her too hard. My mother was the homecoming queen, actually, at McAllister School for Women in St. Paul. She was on her way to becoming a very bright light in the School of Social Sciences. She had a scholarship to a big school in St. Louis, and everything in her life told her not to do it. Her parents told her not to do it. You have to get married. You have to settle down. You have to procreate. You have to get a kid. My mother was not into that. She was not of the time. She was, unfortunately, the time of the late 30s and 40s, where women were to do a certain thing. They were to serve your man. That whole arcane ideology, that whole arcane habit. but she was caught in it and she was trapped.
And do you think that, so are you saying that you think 100% of sort of the violence and the rage she threw at you was resentment toward having you, or did she also have?
She resented the whole idea of being a mother. Anything that was pertaining to her being a mother, she resented. Even though she loved me, she hated me for being there, for having had the need to create me with my father. She did not want to get married. She did not want to have a family. She wanted to have a career. God forbid, you couldn't do that in the 30s and 40s unless you were extremely lucky or extremely strong. Well, my mother gave in and she got married, and that's when everything started going down. She became obese. I mean, she literally became obese in a matter of a year. I don't know if I've ever shown you a picture of her when she was homecoming queen, but she was like drop dead beautiful. She was. But in a year, she became obese. She hated herself. That was clear. I didn't know that. I couldn't analyze that when I was a kid. I just took the brunt of it. And she drank. And that stopped eventually, fortunately, but she was drinking. She was doing anything to get away from the life that she was forced to live. And my father was stuck with that. Now, this day and age, if some couple gets together, that happens, usually it ends in divorce. You're not going to put up with that shit. Well, they were of a time where you don't split up. And they were also supposedly very devout Christians. And they took a vow till death do us part. They took that seriously, very seriously. I don't know if you've known anybody who took that vow seriously. Very many people say it, but they don't know what the fuck they're saying. And when they come to it, they say, no, 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 that's not going to happen. It's too much work. Now, I'm not against divorce or anything. I think some people shouldn't be married. Maybe they find out that they shouldn't be married. I think that vow should be done away with because it doesn't make any sense. But they took that vow serious according to the ideology that was born into the Missouri Synod Lutheran ideology. You do that for life. So they stuck it out.
Did your father offer you comfort and love in the face of this, or did he just abandon ship and head down into the basement?
He would abandon ship, but he would try very hard. He loved to help me with my schoolwork, and we'd go into my room and close the door, and he would help me with my math homework. He actually had a remarkable mathematical mind, and he knew that, but he was persuaded to go into another business. There were all sorts of misdirections in his life that he fell into, or traps, like I say, sand traps, that he fell into. He actually had a very, very sharp mathematical mind. He could have become very big in actual sciences. He could have gone very far in that because he could do a lot of things with numbers. Not as good as John von Neumann, the human supercomputer, nothing like that. But he could calculate things in his mind. He had a way of doing algebra, and he was able to communicate algebraic ideas, which made me fall in love with mathematics because of my father's love for it. He had a natural knack for it, so he helped me a lot in my math. And for a long time, I was in love with math. That's what I did all through college, the first stint in college in the 70s in math. And my father helped me with that. And we were also – he had a vegetable garden. He loved growing vegetables. He had a modest vegetable garden. We grew like 12 vegetables that we would use, that we'd harvest every year, and it would keep the family fed for most of the winter. With vegetables, we never had to buy any because we had a storehouse of vegetables that my mother would can. She was very good. When she worked with food, she was perfectly sane, and she could can, and she could make bread to knock your mock. Oh, you thought my bread was good? You should have tasted my mother's. Oh, my God.
I wish I had. Let me ask you this. I mean, you probably know that there has been quite a bit of scholarship from psychiatrists and psychologists about the good enough mother, Winnicott's phrase, the good enough mother, and sort of the maternal schizogenic factor that sort of not having a good enough mother, having a mother that isn't able to provide an emotional connection and safety with the child, but in fact breaches that sort of important bond and that important nurturing feature of life in the early life with violence and rage and with mixed signals and with with psychotic demands and just a host of problematic, non-nurturing, non-comforting behaviors toward the child, that it has been seen as being schizogenic, meaning causing schizophrenia. Now, some people find this mother bashing or woman bashing. But you know, there has been a lot of talk of that they find that the schizophrenics have had problematic mothers, and maybe it's that the fathers, even if they were nurturing and trying to make up for that problem in the home, never quite did, or are not even in a place with the young child to do that. That the mother connection with the child is so primitive and formative that in the absence of it, even a father trying to make up for it can't really get rid of the negative consequences of it. I don't know. I just wanted to say that's out there and see if you have a sort of a reaction to the idea of the schizogenic role of the not good enough mother. Do you think that's something that rings true with you or what?
Well, yeah, it does. It does ring true with me, but it makes me think about other friends that I've had who have had mothers who are non-nurturing, that I would say that the messages are so split and they're so mixed that you don't know what's happening. It's just chaotic. Where a friend of mine was treated so poorly by his mother, she would go into like crazy psychotic behavior during the PMS cycle. She would actually attack him with sharp implements, and he had to actually flee and defend himself, or he would have been killed. That succeeded in suppressing his emotions. So as I knew him as an adult, this talks a little bit about me, because I think about Tom a great deal. We are no longer friends. We had kind of a falling out the last couple of years. We tried to rekindle our friendship. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. The fact is that his emotions were totally suppressed. The fact that to the point where he couldn't emote with other human beings. He couldn't relate to other human beings. But he wasn't psychopathic. He actually had tests for that. It turned out he had a lot of trouble with empathy, and I could tell that. But he wasn't a psychopath because he could emote very much in watching films. He could weep while watching films and getting involved with fictional characters, and that was interesting to me.
That's I think maybe the good enough mother phrase has maybe phased out because it's so hard to define what that is, and it's obviously fairly unscientific. And also, there's obviously been people with not good enough mothers, if we want to say that, who have not become schizophrenic. But it has been noted that there, you know, with the young child, with the difficult mother, that can bring things to a head in the appearance of schizophrenic symptoms later on. Let me move on to you know, after we talk about your parents and
go ahead. I did have very strong reactions to my mother. And there was a time in my young adulthood where I was planning to kill her. And I actually came close to doing that. But since I had a conscience, it didn't.
When you say you came close, what do you mean?
I had a butcher knife in my hand. I was going to go into her room and I was going to cut her throat.
You were in the house? You were in the house with her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When I was like 15 or something, I was in high school.
Yeah.
And the enormity of what happened to me as a child, I remember a whole week. Nothing ever happened. There was no expression of violence, but there was a desire to kill her. And I remember one night I had one of the kitchen chef blades in my hand. I was sitting in my room, and my room was just adjacent to my parents' room. My father was gone. My mother was in there. And I was debating with myself to kill her. And I came very close to making the decision, yes, I'm going to kill this woman. It's good that I didn't, because I probably wouldn't be here right now. I'd be in another situation. But I came very close because the rage had built up so much and come right to the fore that this is the monster that has fucked up your life to this point. She has stolen so many things from you, and you're not going to put up with this shit anymore. And it wasn't even wrathful. It was a very cold decision. I wasn't going, ha, 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 ha. I was very, very calmly going to my room, and I cut her throat. And I'm going to walk out of the house. I came very close to doing that. I don't think I've ever told you that.
No, I don't think you have. I might have put it in the play.
But I'm very happy that I didn't go through with it.
Yeah, of course. Me too.
My life very ugly.
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. After the parent section, and we hear you voicing the harsh and the soft, the supportive voice of your father, the harsh voice of your mother. We hear you being torn, as you say, it's ugly in the middle, or it's lonely in the middle. It's not lonely in the middle. It's sort of stuck between them. After that section, we go on to hear about what you call the schizophrenic body. And I do remember specifically that this section is based in you telling me during some of our conversations that there were times when you felt your body was, parts of your body were flying off or falling off, or your body was decomposing. You were falling apart. You start the section with, but if I told you how troubling things can be for a man with his head in the clouds when those clouds are in his head, it seems I've not. So you actually say, you know, I don't think I've even really quite shown you how hard things have been. So you say, therefore, it is for you to enter my body. So you say to the audience, you know, I need to take you into my body to really show you how troubling this situation is. And you need to come in precognitively, not thoughtfully, not with your thinking, but with something deeper, something physical, that you might grasp at its straws, the straws of your body, and carry the play or carry the day for yet another day, that you might go on to consider, I don't know what thingling, that you might continue on and consider what the schizophrenic body is like. So tell us about the schizophrenic body, what it was like having a body being schizophrenic.
Well, I was, I just spent a number of hours listening to people talk about their body in a way that I could relate to. They went to extremes that say that parts of their body doesn't belong to their body, so they went to have them excised. People actually had their arms cut off. They're perfectly good arms, but they've suddenly felt the arm doesn't belong to them anymore. And so they want to cut it off. And I remember, wow, I was listening to this video talking to people who have actually gone through it. They either have it auto-excised or have doctors cut their bodies apart. And I never got to that point, but I knew that my body sometimes didn't belong to me, and I wanted it back. It wasn't that I wanted to throw it away. It's just that I don't know what my arm's doing, but it doesn't belong to me anymore. My legs don't belong to me anymore. My hands, my arms, they're just not part of me. I have to get them back. I have to figure out a way to get my arms back. It's not that I wanted to get rid of the arm because it was no longer mine. It was usurped by some being or whatever, and it's gone. So it doesn't belong on my body, so I want to cut it off. It didn't never thought about that. But as I'm listening to these people talk about that actual experience, it's a big problem with some people. And it's a real condition. I don't know if it's gone into the psychological manual or not, but I think it's almost there. There's a name for that condition. I can't remember it, but it's very similar to the kind of ways I thought about my body sometimes. But it would be like fibromyalgia. The condition that floats around the body, that this time my shoulder hurts really badly, but now my knee hurts really badly, but now my left hip hurts really badly. It's a floating condition. And there's a lot of controversy about fibromyalgia. They don't know whether it's a psychological or physical problem. They think it's kind of a blend of the two. There's a lot of controversy about it. I'm sure you know about that. And that really I can relate to as well. Okay, this part of my body hurts today. This part of my body is, I got to talk this back. I got to talk this arm back into being with my body because I want my arm. I don't want to get rid of it. So I'd have dialogues with my arms and my legs and my teeth and my eyes and various parts of my body, but it'd never be the same. It would float around my hair. It's not my hair. I have to get my hair back on my head. And you don't talk about that with other people because they think you're fucking nuts. And of course, it is nuts. And yeah. So you got to keep that to yourself. So it was a condition that I was struggling with, but it never had any overt display. It was all internal. And it mostly manifested in me becoming very, very quiet. And I was pretty much quiet all my life. I didn't interrelate with a lot of people. And those are things that kind of forced me to fight with myself, my body, to try to keep it today. And sometimes that whole feeling of being parts of despair would go away. And suddenly I was whole again. And suddenly my body was all working. My arms were working, my other arms, my legs were working, my legs, my feet, my body, my legs, my heart, my head, my shoulders. All of that was working together. But then it would come back. Oh, my ear is not part of me anymore. And I would have to talk to my ear. I'd have conversations. And that whole section that you wrote made a lot of sense to me. You could have elaborated that with a very elaborate discussion and actual scenes that I would have with my nose and my chin. But the way you described it was very accurate. And whatever I said in my conversations with you, put that on a page. I think it's very accurate. But it's encapsulated. It's in brief. It's like a little
Nudge.
It's like a little footnote. Those things that happened would go on for hours and sometimes days.
Yeah.
Fighting to get my body back to my body.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I remember the teeth thing. I know on Nasher, on Cuspid, on Psychic Tusk. that's the section, right? Yeah, I remember you talking about feeling like your teeth were flying away, like reindeer. Yeah,
arms are a nervous pastiche of Thor and Rubbermaid.
Yeah, you've got for all the little. Yeah, I've passed for all the little foils and blurs. The schizophrenic body is a place no one's ever been because we're all born there aggressively in this annoyingly self-directed manner. And though we try to secrete interferon in our likeness, we fail because we're schizophrenic. Displaying a prehensile split among affect, ideation, and expression. I think affect, ideation, and expression. So I can't remember if those were your phrases. I think you might have taught me that little triad of things. Schizophrenia is typified by a split among affect, ideation, and expression. So feeling, thought, and the expression of those feelings and thoughts. So you have a feeling, but it doesn't quite make it into a thought. And you have a thought, but it doesn't quite make it into an expression. Or you're having a feeling, but you can't quite express it, or you express something different.
It doesn't follow a natural thing. Like, it doesn't connect dots. There's not a clear causal relationship between affect, ideation, and expression, as it would be in a normally functioning human being who's calm. In a schizophrenic individual, that's constantly derailing. One affect goes to another, the ideation goes to another expression. They don't have anything to do with one another sometimes. The affect doesn't lead into an ideation that makes any sense.
Yeah.
It's like, why am I having those thoughts? This affective feeling, there's not connected. Why is this happening? And then the expression of that is completely something else.
Yeah.
I think that's what you were trying to say. And you
did it. Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you know, and the interesting thing when I hear that is, after this phrase, we fail because we're schizophrenic, displaying a prehensile split among affect, ideation, and expression, which is just a fans club way of saying you can't act. Meaning, you know, the actor, to me, like maybe a really thrilling definition of the actor is healing that split.
That's right.
Among affect, ideation, and expression, and becoming a triple threat of affect, ideation, and expression, all aligned and putting it out there on the stage. And that's kind of what I was getting at with acting. You know, it seems like when you were acting, you were able to bridge that split among affect, ideation, and expression.
That's when I acted, that became logical. There was a causal relationship between them. There's this fan club's way of saying you can't act, but in my own experience, that's when I could act. Is when I was acting, I could act. I could get rid of the confusion between affect, ideation, and expression when I was acting, because it all made sense. But when I wasn't acting, I think I can't possibly go on stage. I can't get my thoughts in order. I can't connect the two. But when I did, I act, when I was working with objective and intentions on stage, they all flowed. And I could act.
Yeah,
I could become whole temporarily in my mind when I was acting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's.
But you see, schizophrenics can't act because you got to own your body to give it up. That's where it's a little inaccurate. In my case, the schizophrenic could act, because when I was acting, I did own my body.
I think that there's references to this in the play. Maybe in my own defense, I'm not sure it's a question of right or wrong. I think that one of the things that's being posited in the play is this idea that when you were acting, you weren't schizophrenic, or that there was a cessation of symptoms. There was a cessation of the split among affect, ideation, and expression. The voices and visions ceased, that there was kind of a transformation that occurred, that you were literally a schizophrenic off stage and a non-schizophrenic on stage, which I think, I'm going to put this out there, I think is an interesting, fact, especially for if we still have the goal of curing schizophrenia, healing schizophrenia. Maybe there's something in the art of acting. Maybe there's something in the act of theater. Maybe there's something in that process that might be informative to people looking to transform from being schizophrenic to being post-schizophrenic. Because in a sense, you cannot act when you're schizophrenic. You can only act when you're not schizophrenic, but schizophrenics clearly, as you prove, have the ability to be non-schizophrenic while acting.
That's not just me. And also, I'm trying to think of a man, his name is John something. He started a whole group. This is back in the 70s. It was very progressive thinking, where he tried to go against the pharmaceutical idea of drugging everybody and making them medicated in their insane asylums, and so nothing had happened, is that he had the idea that schizophrenia was a healing process for the psyche. I do believe that in my own experience, I went through a remission and I became more of me through that remission. So I tend to believe he was right. But the thing is, he would take people, a whole group of people. He got funding. I think it was through the Reagan administration, but maybe even before that. They gave him a lot of money to assemble the people. And they thought he was kind of a joke. Okay, give us, humor him, and so he can see that he's not right. But it was working. He would do theater games with these people that were really badly psychotic, so psychotic they couldn't take care of themselves and they were a danger to themselves and others, so they were in a state hospital. So he took a whole group of these very severely psychotic people and he worked with them for about a year. He was given them. They had a house to live in. They had everything. It was very expensive, but he did that. And 95% of those people healed. 95% of those people after the year showed them to be barely sane, responsible people and could leave the hospital. That was a threat to the pharmaceutical empire. And they shut him down. Because those theater games were really helping those people. This you touched on in this whole section. You touched on that. I'm trying to think of the guy's name.
I've read the book too. I'll find out the name. I know who you're talking about. Also, I don't know if I've ever told you, but my sister is a psychiatrist in LA and, she has studied schizophrenia for a long time. And I'm thinking it would be really interesting to bring her on for an episode and see what she has to say about all this, but I'll hold that for a later time. And I'll find out the name of that book. I remember it well. I have it on my shelf somewhere. So I want to move on and I want to, We move on after that section about the schizophrenic body to you saying, after a few unforgettable years of infant amnesia, enter, chased by an unbearable awe, voices and visions.
From blanket charges to anybody here want to blame me?
Yeah. So, voices, you started getting voices and visions when, and what were they like? What were they?
That began very early, in experience, a lot of schizophrenic conditions don't show up until the late teens or early 20s, commonly. And they don't know really why, but that seems to be the time when it starts appearing in people. But me, I had visions of angels when I was like in kindergarten. In my room, I remember. And I never had the idea of now I'm having a hallucination. I had a really active imagination, and I couldn't dissociate that from just having an active imagination, a daydream. So I didn't think there was anything wrong with seeing an angel in my room. And these angels were very loving. and they were very soft-spoken.
I think you say in the play that you saw them as emanations of your father.
Yes, my father very, very, I can't even remember my father yelling, but that's really all I can remember my mother doing.
Right, because there were also voices, the visions were angels like your father, and the voices were harsh, berating, and cruel like your mother. Is that right?
That's very accurate. That's exactly true. And when I was a kid, that's pretty much all I can remember my mother. But my father had a very soft-spoken character. We talked about that. And visions of these angels, there wasn't like wings or anything like that. They were like diffuse things that would show up in my room like a talking light or a pulsing glob of light. They didn't have a human form. There weren't faces or anything like that or wings.
Your sense was that they were out there in space, like hovering in your room. They weren't hallucinations in your mind. You've sensed that they were objectively out there, real world things. Is that right?
That's right. I didn't have any notion that they were occurring in my head.
Yeah.
They were just projections of my mind. I believe that they were right there in the room. These globules, these gentle glowing blue, green globules. They're very gentle light. And it wasn't usually the, long wavelength. It was a short wavelength. It's the blue green.
Yeah.
They're very gentle and it's very soothing. Blue green is some of the most soothing colors to me, whereas red, and it's commonly red's grating, red's fighting, red's anger. And that was commonly true. Now, I remember any red vision, any red angel. They were always like shimmering blue green or that part of the spectrum.
Tell me about the voices. Did you sense that the voices were coming at you from, like, say, over in the closet or over across the room, or were they in your head? And was it a mix of your voice and your mother's voice and a strange voice, or what was the? How would you describe the character of those voices?
The character of the voices were all their own, but the voices were so grating, much like my mother. I associated them sort of with my mother, but I didn't really make that association. I didn't think about it. They were grating, like they had a curl in the back. That's how they had to roll around, as if they were behind me. And I always felt that they were in the room. I didn't feel like they were in my head. I felt they were in the room. But I never saw anything. I just heard something like, hey, hey, like, duh, duh. They'd be very grating and sharp. So did I jumped.
Did that scare you?
Sort of like those dreams you have, like you're sort of in the hypnagogic state, you jump.
Yeah. So was that scary? Was that scary? You were like, nobody's here, yet I'm hearing voices. I mean, were you scared as a kid?
Sure. It vacillated between these soothing visions of soothing colors and those grating voices. And it was, there was no rhyme or reason to it. There was no rhythm to it. I couldn't predict when it was going to, it was like, what's the composer? The 12 tone. It's got, Shostakovich? No. Is that it? No.
Schoenberg?
There we go. Schoenberg's friend, 12 tones. It felt like math. It was like dissociative, like free jazz. Ornette Coleman's free jazz was chaotic. It was like really, really rattling me. And I never knew what was going to happen. I always wanted those visions. And those visions of the soft soothing would happen at night usually. Fortunately, they happened at night, and those voices, those hard breathing voices that were like, they would happen during the day. And they happened during the day, like at school or where I was out and about, and I would jerk. And some people sometimes would say, well, are you all right? I remember a teacher once asked me, I jerked really hard at my desk, and some things on my desk fell off the desk. And Mrs. Lau said, Dan, are you all right? See, I obviously made some violent gesture to turn around. This voice was assaulting me from the back, and I kind of startled all the students that were next to me because, of course, they didn't see or hear anything. I remember being extremely embarrassed by that. I didn't get in trouble, but she noted it, and she wrote it down. And about a week after that little experience, I had a talk with the school counselor.
Yeah.
They didn't find anything wrong with me because I knew kind of what was going on. And
yeah.
These were protected. This was me. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with me. I just thought it was me.
Yeah. Let's, after this section, yeah. Well, that leads me to the question of I can't remember, like, when were you actually diagnosed as schizophrenic? It was later in life, right? So nobody was using the word schizophrenia with you when you were under 20 years old, right?
No, I didn't hear that word pertaining to me until I was 50.
Ah, okay.
Until I was much later, and where it got so bad that there was such a collision of drug use and alcohol use and chaotic personal life and hallucinations where I just was committed and I was put into hospital situation.
Okay.
And where I was totally out of control, it was very clear there was no hiding it.
Yeah.
You know, remember the doctors talking to me very gently. They were actually very nice. They were trying to talk to me as an individual. They didn't think of me as a label to put on, well, he's schizophrenic. Let's put that label on him and just refer to him as a schizophrenic Dan. No, they talked to me. They were very nice. But they did talk about the condition, schizoaffective condition, schizophrenia. And they would talk to me at length. They would ask me questions about what is it to hear something? What is to see something? And for whatever reason in that time in my life, which is now jumping very, very far ahead, is that I said, fuck it. I no longer can protect anything. I'm just going to give up the goods like a spy who's been caught. And everybody knows it. I've been made. There's no point in trying to deny it. Yeah, I'm a double agent. Yeah, I work for this, and this is what I know. It was kind of that feeling I was giving up the goods to the enemy.
Yeah.
That was the feeling I had when I was in the hospital. And I neither resented them or was happy about them. I just felt caught.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. Well, cool. We're going to get to that hospital section in a little while. The next section that we touch on, the play flows into this next section. We encounter Timothy, who you call your comforting vision man. Tell us about Timothy, when you first saw Timothy, what Timothy was like.
Timothy was a unique vision. He actually gave me advice on how to handle certain things that Dan Burkey didn't know how to handle. Like, he gave me advice about when he first appeared. I honestly can't pin a date on that. I thought about that a lot, but it was very real. It was in my early adolescence. And then when the hormones were starting to get up and I was becoming a sexual being, overtly sexual being, and he would try to give me advice about how to handle girls. Because I was terrified of girls. And all through my life, my relationship with women and girls was a train wreck. Until this very last one, which I'm having now, but it's the only relationship that's ever worked with another woman, is what I'm having now, which I've had for the last 10 years. But at that particular time, it was just like impossible. And I would have crushes on girls. I wouldn't know how to talk to them. And Timothy would give me a little, you know, Dan, maybe if you just don't say anything. Don't say that, Dan. Just be nice to her. Just be smiling. Don't come on like you're coming on too strong. That's why she doesn't want to talk to you. You're jumping and you're jumping up and down. You're scaring her. Just calm down, Dan. Calm down. I can tell she likes you, but just be at ease, you know, just smile and say, maybe give her some of your lunch, you know. He would try to give me advice on how to handle women. And I never really took he gave advice, but I was never able to realize that advice very well. I was really fuck up as far as I'm concerned. He would come and say, oh, Dan, no, you got to listen to me, Dan. If you just listen to me, Dan. Please, Dan, the next time you want to talk to a girl, let me give you an advice. Let me tell you what to say so you don't screw it up. Dan, you're just kind of getting in your own way all the time. I remember using that phrase, getting in your own way. He was trying.
He was like a rational friend who.
He was an advisor on all sorts of things.
Would he sometimes just appear and like stare at you, or was he always talking?
He would appear, and whenever he appeared, and I construed his appearance, which again wasn't the physical form of body there with a man of the recognizable face. It was more just an image like before of scintillating lights with a very particular personality. These lights had a very personality, and it was Timothy. When he there, when I saw the vision was there, when he was appearing, I felt calm. I felt like something was taking care of me. It was like my conception of a god, you can think of that way, or a guardian angel. Yeah. It was there to protect me. I never used those phrases, guardian angel, but now thinking about it in retrospect, that essentially was what it became. Because as I was born and raised in that ideology, I did have a belief system that included the guardian angel, but it was never really practiced other than read about in terms of the Bible and all that. But when Timothy was there and comforting me, I never referred to him or thought of him as a guardian angel, but that's exactly what he was doing. He was being a conception of the guardian angel that I had contracted in my mind.
Yeah. Cool. Great. Well, we hear more about Timothy as the play goes on and he appears in at different times.
Yeah, he appeared throughout my life.
Yeah.
And then near the end, and he never appeared to me again. I keep on thinking of the tempest, Plustra, finally putting the staff down, putting the book down and saying farewell to Ariel, which is a very tearful thing for me. I performed Prospero actually and saying goodbye to Ariel. And I know that he'll be gone. He's never coming back. It was like when I said goodbye.
Did you know when he left, when he was leaving, did you say goodbye to him?
I knew he was leaving. There wasn't a tearful goodbye. It just was a
yeah,
very strong, powerful feeling of thanks. It was tearful, but it wasn't like, oh my God, what am I going to do now? Oh
yeah.
My God. It was like, thank you for being there and fair journey to you.
Yeah.
It was sadness. You're saying goodbye to a very good friend, but you know you have to say goodbye.
Yeah.
You just have to, you know that you're saying goodbye.
In the play, that disappearance of Timothy takes place in connection with you stopping drinking and having the DTs. And once the DTs passed and the drinking was over and you entered that kind of post-addictive phase in your life, that Timothy left. Is that accurate, or is that
my... That's pretty much true.
Yeah.
He had done his best. He knew what I needed. I had kind of observed what I needed to do. At that point, we're talking about, as I finally understood, I finally grasped that I was an addict, that I had to take it seriously, or nothing was ever going to happen. And so that's when I finally got the courage to put all the drinking drugs down for good. And then I knew that I would never touch them again. That's when I threw them away. And Timothy, I think, knew that, or I knew that. Part of me that was Timothy knew that. I'd come to an understanding, so there was no more need of Timothy.
Yeah.
I'd assimilated that help completely into myself, so he never appeared outside of me because now he was inside. I mean, he was always inside, but the manifestation of something other than me was gone.
Yeah. Great. Okay, thank you. So we move on to this section that I've always called the double bind section. And this for me is a section that has a little bit of classic schizophrenic theory mixed with kind of trying to sprinkle that theory into your experience. And you say the Journal of Garbology defines the double bind as a recurrent state wherein conflicting injunctions are imposed on the victim by persons of respect. And I, when I wrote that, I kind of had in mind your mother, and this is, you know, and you later go on, the double bind was first posited as a causal factor in schizophrenia when visited on the young, unstable, or weak. For when a victim cannot sense the contradictions in which he lives, mental anxiety can escalate unchecked by self-regard. And the double bind is basically that, you know, your mother says, or a parent or a person of authority says, obey or be punished. So obey me or you will get punished. But underneath that injunction, there's another one that says, obey, but only if you want to. So they put a sort of a false sense of freedom on the person they're making this injunction to. But then underneath that, often there's also obey, and if you don't, you will effectively be killing me. So there's guilt, there's false freedom, and there's threat all in one. Does that ring? What does that all mean to you? And does that relate to your mother? And what do you have to say about the double bind?
It translates to me more about cult introduction, indoctrination, more than it does my experience with schizophrenia. And I know you've written this into it. I never performed this section. This was written and we read it and for the book. I appreciated this a great deal, but it was like a very philosophical breakdown of what happens within. And I think obey only if you want to is at the point where the person has been broken down by the cult leader, the point where they feel like they got it, they're going to follow the cult leader because they want to. And they're going to obey it and they want to. But they're bracketed by obey or be punished, obey or die. There's these brackets, these bookends. And they've got these people trapped, these cult members or the schizophrenic condition that is controlling as a cult leader is that you have this feeling of being free within the bounds of the hallucinations that are overtaking you. And there were times when I felt like I'm just going to let go. And it was a wonderful feeling of freedom where I didn't feel like I needed to answer to anybody. And that's oftentimes when I got into trouble because I was obeying certain impulses that were definitely against the law. And that would be translated, obey or be punished, was oftentimes what happened when I would go too far and I would be disciplined. I would be taken to the principal's office or later in life, I'd be arrested. And it was like, it's true. I never thought of this. It's a very accurate. It's very eloquent. And I've been thinking a lot about the double bind ever since I was introduced to it for the book. I thought about it a lot, and I'm saying, that's very correlative to my own experience, but I never would have put it that way. But it's Kirk's brilliance, and he's thought about it, and now it makes a great deal of sense. But you put it in a way, because I told you that reading it as if it's me is actually kind of not me, because I'm not a philosophical person like you. Mm. I don't have a mind, and this is not self-deprecating. I just don't have a philosophical mind. And that's okay with me entirely. You do. And you can put these things together to make sense of something that's very abstruse. And you can explain this to somebody who doesn't go, what the fuck is this? But you can explain it. Much like you explained to me while we were working on it for the book. I found that fascinating, but it's definitely not Dan.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple times in the play, admittedly, where I decided to insert some philosophical stuff, definitely with the metaphor and the maker.
But I'm not complaining.
I think sure. Yeah, of course, of course. Give me the microphone, and I'm bound to talk. Let's move on. The next session is Mr. Tenesmith on the Sabbath, which I call the bathroom scene. Tenesmith, some people might not know, is the frequent urge to go to the bathroom without being able to go. And I don't mean go physically into a restroom, but I mean it's the urge to pee or to poop and not be able to do so. The bathroom scene, where Mr. Tenesmith on the Sabbath, visits you and sexually assaults you. Are you okay talking about that?
I'm fine. It's right there in the play.
Why don't you tell us about that section? If you're cool with it, tell me what you told me that was the spawn to that spawned that section.
Section is basically a condensation of a lot of experiences. I was molested by a number of teachers. And it placed in a rhetoric that was not the way it went. It was a lot more abrupt. There wasn't many talk. It would just come in and assault me. There'd be no talk. He would just grab me, pull my pants down, and fuck me in the ass. There would be no talk.
This happened to you frequently from multiple teachers?
Yeah.
What kind of school were you going to? What's going on here?
These things happen in Ethel Baston Elementary School, the first school I went to when I was living in St. Louis Park with my parents, which is a township not very far from Minneapolis proper, for 2 years in kindergarten, first grade, in the same school. And there were several teachers that had assaulted me. I think they probably had a little proof. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if there was a pedophile cell at that area, and they were all in cahoots. I was like, sort of, got the feeling I was being passed around, and I felt impotent in the fact that I couldn't help it. There was no way to complain. There was no way to tell my parents. I never did. I had no words for it. And as soon as I'd go home, as soon as I was away for a weekend, I'd forget about it. My body, my mind would shove it in the background. So I wasn't assaulted by that conscious memory, which is a way the mind protects itself.
And you never did tell your parents or anybody else about this?
No, the only person I actually talked to about this was the therapist that I had between 2006 and 2008 at the C.G. Jung Center, a very fine analyst. He really helped me a great deal, and we went the whole process of recognizing the sexual molestation, itemizing it, and making it very clear, making it very specific, and moving through it to let it go was the entire intention, the objective for those 2 years that I was with this man. And it was successful. That I could successfully let go. I could talk about these things, about how he fucked me in the ass, and at one point he made me suck his cock, and he'd make me smear his cum over my face, and he would make me masturbate, which I couldn't because it never was sexually exciting, so it was flaccid. And he tried to masturbate me, and it was very frustrating to him. He never hit me, but it was clear he was very upset. But he'd get excited and fuck me in the ass again. And this went on for a long time, but there was no dialogue like this. This is a theatrical manifestation of it. I think it's quite wonderful. I think it's really, really quite beautiful because it touches on a number of things, but that's not how it happened.
Sure.
It was very abrupt. There was no tone.
Yeah. I guess that would be the film version. Okay. Well, that's heavy. That's heavy news.
It is, but it used to be terrible news for me. I couldn't talk about it, but I can remember in my mind exactly what happened, and it doesn't bother me at all anymore.
Yeah, good.
Not at all.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So the next section after the bathroom is math, the knuckle of the invisible hand. You talked a little bit about math earlier, about your dad. What did math come to mean to you? What was math to you? But I think maybe even more importantly,
was there a
connection between math and schizophrenia or anything like that?
Manifestation of the angels in me. Math was a manifestation of the angels coming to me, coming through me, and let me express myself in mathematics because I was very good at mathematics. I wasn't brilliant. I wasn't a John Nash, but I was very good at mathematics. I was excellent at it. And I could express myself mathematically. I actually blew some teachers away by proving certain things in the ways that they had never thought of. And I remember that happened in fourth grade. I remember being up at the blackboard and proving the Pythagorean theorem in a way that nobody had ever seen. And the teacher was like, kind of dumbfounded that I actually done it. And I remember I got into a talk with other people, and they actually brought a mathematician into the school to talk with me about that proof that I'd done on the keys, but nobody had ever seen it before. And it was like, maybe somebody had done it before. I'm not telling you these were world-class mathematicians, but there was something from a school like Carleton College in Minnesota somewhere. But he came in and he said, wow, this is amazing. Let me write it down. Would you mind writing this up so we could like publish it and put your name on it? And so actually there is a publication out there with my name on it when I was in fourth grade. For the proof of the Pythagorean theorem that I had come up with. So the thing was, it was a manifestation of something so brilliant and beautiful in me that I felt the angels were inside me now. And now I could do something. I felt like I had a superpower. I felt like I could now do something, like really do something. And I needed that. I needed that. Timothy helped me up to a certain point, but I found something. I found sort of a small, minor holy grail. And now it was mine. And I could do it. And in a way that the voices no longer have very great power over me, and that the angels had led me to this. And I was very good at it. And it went on for years. It went on for years. And people respected me. And finally, people were not making fun of me. And that was a great change in my life between fourth grade and fifth grade, where people were looking at me like, this kid may be a mathematical genius. So people started looking at me differently.
Yeah. And my father
was very proud. My father was extremely happy and proud that I was getting recognized for that. And by the time like sixth and seventh grade showed up, I went to Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota, on a special symposium for mathematical kids. And I met some of the most brilliant mathematical kids that Minnesota had to offer. And they were a hell of a lot smarter than me. These were like junior John Nashes. So it was exciting. I never minimized by them. They do amazing stuff with the blackboard. But the thing is, I could follow it. If I really worked at it, I could follow it. I was with this group of mathematical kids that was just so beautiful. But that came to an end. And it just
You say in the play, you say math beget college scholarship, beget the University of Minnesota Physics Department, beget hooked on smack.
Yeah.
All at the same unsustainable time. So are you saying that your math abilities beget a scholarship to the University of Minnesota, but you blew that scholarship by getting hooked on heroin?
Well, there was a physics postgraduate student who befriended me, and I liked him. There was nothing sexual to it, but he wanted to say, hey, Dan, you want to really ride the white tiger? And I didn't know what he meant, but I did. I went ahead with it, and he told me how to do it. It wasn't a sudden slippery slope into the abyss. It was very gradual because for the first couple of years, it was very controlled. I knew when to get high and when not to get high. And nobody really knew that I was getting high because I always wore long shorts. I could show people my infections. But I only did it when I had time to do it. So that's what the postgraduate math guy instructed me was be careful. Time it out. You can't do it every day, all day. And there were many years went by that I had it under control. But then it took over eventually. It just took over. The addiction grabbed me. It was like kind of luring me in. Come on, Dan. Come on. This is fun, isn't it? I'd go, yeah, it is really kind of neat. I'm seeing a lot of cool shit, man. This is fun. And I could have a life too, a girlfriend. I could get a job and all that. See, Dan, yeah, just go a little deeper. Go a little deeper. It finally got me. But the addiction took over. And then it was no more choice. I had to shoot up several times a day. Finding five or six times a day, doing shooting up subgrade heroin, cut with all sorts of shit that probably wasn't even safe. It's amazing I didn't kick it. But it was like sudden. It was like a gradual kind of like, this is kind of fun. I can keep doing this and people can kind of take me or not take me. And then suddenly it grabbed me and I just went into this nosedive, a supersonic nosedive into the abyss. I can't really pin a point when that happened, but it did. Like a blink. And suddenly I was in trouble. And suddenly I had no more control over anything.
Yeah, I mean, you say that you move on later to say graduated, nodding, meaning hooked on smack, and paranoid enough to get a job at Honeywell and unfairly lose it in 7 months simply because I failed to show up. So essentially you got a job at Honeywell and you blew it. I did what any self-disrespecting poppy jock or, you know, heroin addict would do after snorting snot from a viral cousin. I started acting. So clearly the heroin was keeping you from having a job, keeping you from taking advantage of the opportunities that were coming to you. And you started acting. And so this is when you started acting. And the thing we see in the play, which you told me about, is the Nootkin Kluk Whaley. So, we have you performing in the play in remission.
Smith's Museum of Minnesota.
Yeah, a crazy little, obviously not historically correct in any way, rendition of the Nootkin Kluk Whaley. It's kind of the Nootkin Kluk Whaley on heroin or on Bromley. So tell us about the Nootkin Kluk Whaley and your initiation, your entry into acting.
Well, they're not really simultaneous. My introduction into acting happened in 1979. The Nootkin Kluk Whaley happened in 1984. So there's quite a jump between when I started acting, when I gave up the job at Honeywell. I walked out. I had security clearance. I got in trouble, but I had a certain level of a security clearance that was violated because I just didn't show up one day. And so they sent out security to find me, and I was hauled in. And they wanted to know. I was like debriefed. The security clearance was withdrawn. They wanted to know where I'd been, who I'd been talking to. And I finally convinced them. I didn't talk to anybody. I was just getting high. And I think they finally realized I was just getting high. And they said, oh, fuck it. The guy's a heroin head. Just let him alone. Don't arrest him. So they just withdrew my security clearance and said, bye-bye. That was that. But I had taken up acting. I decided I was going to just start acting. And at that point, I took a couple of classes at the University of Minnesota.
How did that idea occur to you? How did that come about?
Well, it was a friend of mine, Hope. She never is mentioned in the play, but Hope Lee Radebaugh was a friend of mine who was actually the girlfriend of a man named Paul Williamson, who's one of the big executives in Lexus and Toyota right now. He's huge. Paul Williamson, if you Google him and Lexus together, you will come up with an enormous number of hits. I'm incredibly proud of it. He was a friend of mine when I was going to the University of Minnesota from 1974 to 78. He was a very good friend, and we are still friends, but he is like on another level right now. But anyway, his girlfriend at the time, Hope, was in the acting department, and she knew that I was having some trouble. She didn't know the extent of it. She didn't know the details, but she said, one day, Dan, she grabbed my hand and said, Dan, I'm going to take you to an acting audition. I went, Hope, are you kidding? What are you? Hope, look at me. I'm a geek. I'm working on my master's. You leave me alone. No, Dan, it's clear nothing's working for you. I just want to show you something. Would you like to go to an audition with me? I said, sure, Hope, I'll go along. And so I went with her to an audition one day at Rarig Acting Center, which is on the west bank of the University of Minnesota. I actually visited that several years ago in 2018 to see if the building was still there. It's exactly the same building, exactly the same type of theaters. Even the whole flooring is exactly set up. Anyway, the same way. So that was freaky to go back there. But she took me by the hand. She looked there. I went to the audition, and I sucked. It was like horrible. It was the worst audition I've ever did. And I was really angry at her. I said, was this a setup? Were you trying to make fun of me? I was really angry at her. And I remember getting really resentful of her. And for a couple of weeks, I didn't have any contact with her. And then I called her and I said, Hope, I overreacted. I'm sorry. I'm sorry I said those things because I know you were trying to help. And she said, well, would you like to try it again? Yeah, I will. This time, could I actually read the script before I go into it? She laughed and said, yeah, that'd probably be a good idea. So she gave me the script and I read through it. And we went to the audition and did it together. And they cast me. Because that time it was night and day. It was like I had the script, I'd calmed down, and I just read it.
Congrats.
In front of the people, and they said, wow, would you like the role of Madhav? This was The Post Office by the Indian poet Rabindranath Tagore.
Mm-hmm.
The Post Office. I played the central character Madhav, the father of the
office. Great.
And I did it. And I got accolade. To the acting department, like, who is this guy? Where'd he come from? Oh, he's in the math department. What?
All right.
No, that was really good. He said, we ought to encourage this guy. This guy is good. So I get all this attention from the acting teachers then, and the students there had a shit fit. They were going, this guy's suddenly getting all the leads. Where did he come from?
Yeah.
He's in the acting department? What is it? I only made a few friends in the acting department because they really were resentful of my showing up. They did not like the fact that I was taking their roles away from them. They've been at the school for like 3 years, and I just show up. And for whatever reason, I knew what I was doing. I don't know what that is. I can't explain it. I really can. I'm not patting myself on the back, just opening up is a big mystery. How did I know what to do? How did I know how to read it? Where did that come from? That opened up a lot of ideas in my head about ideologies, past lives, and all that, but I let that go. I said, well, I can do it, so why don't I just do it? So I kept auditioning for roles, and my life was split. I was actually working at Honeywell. You see, I had taken on the technical life, and I'd gone back to school to complete a few errant credits that I needed, so they allowed me to do that, but I wasn't doing it for math. I was doing it for acting. And all this was kind of combined. And then I came to the realization that I don't want to be in Honeywell anymore. I quit one day, and I already told you what happened to that. Then I went back to the acting department. I said, well, can I continue? I said, well, you're really not a student here anymore. I said, I know that. I know that. Can I work somehow? Well, you can take a class, sort of, I think. So they kind of let me sort of fudge it. I wasn't even a student at the University of Minnesota anymore, and they let me take the class there.
So how did you get in this, the Newtken Kwelly? Tell us about the Newtken Kwelly. The Newtken
Kwelly comes along much later when I was working. I was doing a lot of community theater in the Twin Cities, and I was doing as much as I could. The Twin Cities is a remarkable theater town that has numerous really high-quality community theaters, not just shit community theaters that are going to do another bad production of The Music Man, but really good ones that are trying some brave things. Sure, there are shit theaters, and I got involved in some really bogus productions, but a lot of them are really good. And there is one theater on the West Bank called Theater in the Round on the West Bank of University of Minnesota that's well-known here in New York. It's still a community theater. Actors from New York will take, like, vacations and do a role at the Theater in the Round for free. So anyway.
Is that where you did the Newtken Kwelly?
No. I did the Newtken Kwelly when I became a member of the Science Museum of Minnesota acting troupe in 1984 through 1986.
Okay.
I was a member of the Science Museum's acting troupe, led by a woman named Tessa Bridle. And actually, if you Google Tessa Bridle, who's a Uruguayan emigre, has taken on doing, she's written a lot of very scholarly books about theater as relates to museums and exhibits. And also she's branched into theater as a therapeutic technique for schizophrenic, which is it.
I want to ask this right now, because it's kind of occurring to me. Maybe it's occurring to people who are listening. I was going to kind of save this to the end, because you kind of touch on it at the end, but, I mean, what do you say to people who would say, okay, wait, this guy's working at Honeywell. He's going to graduate school in math. He's joining acting troops. This is not something that schizophrenic people are even able to do. Like, people's vision of schizophrenia is that it's so crippling that you end up, you know, homeless or in an institution.
Those are the tropes that people remember, because those are the tropes that are given to you by movies. They're fed that. There are very few movies that will actually display the condition of schizophrenia accurately. I would say I like The Beautiful Mind, but it was still very inaccurate. If you read Sylvia Nasar's book, which is quite beautiful, about John Nash's actual journey, it touches on what schizophrenia really is. The movie Ron Howard was a Hollywood manifestation of something that really didn't have much to do with John Nash. And John Nash, even when he was alive, he didn't like the film.
So you're saying there schizophrenia is not as dysfunctional or disabling as people think. There are schizophrenics walking among us, in other words.
Yeah. Schizophrenia is a very common condition.
Yeah.
It's a lot more common than people think.
Yeah.
And it's not that thing you'll become slobbering and railing through the streets and knife wielding, killing people. Sure, there are those violent manifestations which are unfortunate, which give schizophrenics a very bad name. But that does happen. I mean, when people are ignored, when the condition gets so bad and nobody's given any help, sometimes it can freewheel totally out of control and people get hurt. And that's unfortunate. But most of the people who are under the condition of schizophrenia are not that way. Their mind is disordered. They can't function in a way, or they function in a way that's much different than people. A lot of them are artists. A lot of them express themselves in writing or poetry or sculpture or painting. There are many examples of very famous painters, Francis Bacon being one, who had the condition and he expressed himself in the painting. And you can see that in the painting. You can see what's going on, the deformations, the body deformations. And you can see that in writing. William S. Burroughs, he communicated in writing beautifully in Naked Lunch. That is the condition of, well, drug addiction, heroin addiction, but also mixed in with severe mental illness. A lot of people don't know what those conditions are. Let us confine ourselves with just schizophrenia and that mental condition. People don't know. They want to go immediately what's digestible, the tropes that the movies give them. That's what they want.
Yeah.
They label a person that way. The people that are truly schizophrenic or are having those symptoms don't display those things at all. And people don't see them as schizophrenic. They may see them as, well, you're kind of eccentric. You have certain habits or kind of weird.
Yeah.
That's kind of the way people looked at me too.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan, he's eccentric. He's weird. He just goes off and does these weird things. And he's just being Dan. And they didn't think of me as being sick. Or yeah. I don't even consider myself being sick now in retrospect, as my mind's trying to find its stability. Given all the instability of my external life, my internal mind is trying to find stability and having a heck of a time doing it.
Wow, great. That's great. Thank you. Super. You know, I think we should end it here today. We'll start next week. We'll start next week with what I call the Bowery section, Providence Hotel, Old Bowery. And go through that and talk about that. But thank you so much for talking and explicating so much of the stuff that's behind this play.
No, it's my pleasure. I love talking about it. It's some things that I kept with myself for a long time. I'm very willing to talk about them, and this gives me an opportunity to express a lot of freewheeling, free association that I've been doing, but the play gives me the opportunity to do that because it doubles back into the play and your expression of the play, which still is a remarkable piece. Anyway, it's my pleasure to do that. It's really my pleasure.
Well, thank you, Dan. I think as always, I was, when we first started talking about the play, I was struck by your bravery in telling me these things. And you referenced that last time. You said, you know, you didn't know me, maybe because you trust me, and it's hard to open up about all this stuff, but now you're opening up about it in a much larger way. And I continue to be impressed by your bravery. So thank you. And, super. Well, you and I are scheduled for a week from today. So, I look forward to talking to you then, Dan. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and love you much. Cool. So I'm going to close the episode with the title track from the Good Hearts album, Going Extinct. For some reason, this song reminds me a bit of, not necessarily Dan, but how should we say, the literary influences that seem to provide source material for Dan's verbal vibe. I've gotten a lot of emails from Dan over the years, and there's something very Burroughs-esque about his approach to imagery and language. And for some reason, this song kind of, I don't know, gave a little bit of that. So I thought I'd talk through the lyrics a little bit. All the great hermaphroditic cleavage dreams are back at work. Stuck phrases in a leave no trace, extreme daughter destruction snore. For the hottest happy victim cage fuck ever, his and hearse. But a man bravely getting off where every man's got off before. All the great dreams of cleaving the hermaphrodite from itself, all the great attempts at splitting the unified sexual being into differentiated identities, are back in full swing. Stuck phrases, just a play on stock phrases. Stuck phrases in a leave no trace, extreme daughter destruction snore.
These dreams are phrases that are stuck in a boring, extreme destruction of daughters that attempts to leave no trace. I guess kind of like a angry porn film or something. For the hottest happy victim cage fuck ever. Stuck phrases for, so these phrases are standing in, they're phrases for, maybe they're in service of, or they're marketing materials for, the hottest happy victim cage fuck ever. His and hers. He and his deathmobile called Love Object. And this cage fuck is about a man bravely getting off where every man's got off before. Yeah, you know. I'm student of the week, an antenatal freak. I'm hot as tank shit. My gunner cranks it. I study the week. I became a freak after I was born. I steam like the back end of a war machine, and my gunner hits hard. And then we there's some stancing, there's some standing up, there's some bragging. There's some war cries. Populate the cracker prior to consumption. Fill that cracker up before you eat him, you know what I mean? Do not run while running from doing the current thing. So, like, you know, you can be against what's going on and you can run from it, but don't run while running from it or you're not going to look too cool. If you lose your feel, if you forget what you're feeling and you don't have any feeling, just stay where you are in a kind of cinematic zest and fight for the privacy of your auto-muted public longing. Be really concerned all the time for making sure that the public desire you've actually turned off stays private. These are commands. These are imperatives for the, staying nice and high while in the hottest happy victim cage fuck ever. Now it says, you were born in a barn, and that barn is okay. It's okay. So you were born like an animal in a barn, like a stock animal, like a stuck animal. Like a used animal, a domesticated beast of burden, of meat, of milk, of feed. And that barn is okay. It's okay. It's okay that that's where you came from. Okay? You were born in a barn. You know, I think Jesus was born in a barn too. You know what I mean? So it's okay. And because you were born in a barn, now you live on a farm, right? You stayed put. You're like a local. You're like a local. You didn't go far. You were raised in this tradition and you're going to stick with it. And that farm is on a runway. Like planes land on it and nothing grows there because if it grew there, it would crash the planes. And c'est la mainstay. That's a living, right? All your means, all your genes, all your memes, all your built on butter schemes are so yesterday. It's all behind you. and it's coming at you down a runway, which is your livelihood, where nothing grows. And then I say, I've come to see that I'm simulated by a payful hate. Somehow I'm a simulated projection of a hate that pays. I don't know who it's paying, but it pays. Such that the beacons of my overdrive now emanate from spermandulas that set me on to procreate with the obstacles my monuments exuviate. So I've come to see that I'm this simulation of a profitable hatred, such that the signs of my incredible compulsion now beam forth from these spermandulas, right? These brief spermic art forms that urge me to go make life with the obstacles that my fixations, my monuments, my exaltations leak. Exude. So I'm mating with my own brief art forms, coming out of the signals of my obsessions, due to my being simulated by a profitable hate. And it's all about having sex with the towers of exaltation that are kind of ejaculating the things that get in my way. Feels very common. Yet, through the muscles of the body that I'm phasing out, right? I'm phasing out this body. Phasing it out. I'm moving on to a new body called dirt. And through the muscles of the body, gush aboriginals. Right? These aboriginal things are gushing down all drifts that never drought. So through these muscles, these aborigines are gushing down these awe-filled drifts that never go dry. Bearing mothers for the beauty murk my pain's about. So mothers are coming out of this gushing. For this murky beauty that my pain seems to be kind of striving toward and being really proud of and making meaning of. Right? And all I got to do to knock those mothers up, all I got to do to get those mothers working for my line is not lock them out. I got to not keep them away. I got to let them come in. I got to let them thrive in the muscles of my body. I got to let those aborigines gush through those drifts. I got to mate with the mothers that they're bearing on their backs. Right. One nature under God. Nature under the gaudy. Right? That's a little bit of a description of where you could say we might be at. Whittle kids with smog. Just shave them down with smog. Take a fear abroad. Spread your fear. Take a fear, go abroad with it, and make sure they catch it too. Uganda mystagogue. Right? Mystical Uganda homosexual death, right? Is there happening. Seeing the good in people built a road through my heart, right? I saw the good in people, and that vision built a road through my heart, a way of going through my heart and letting others go through my heart. And so there was a road there, and so I stood in the road, Because, like, there's the road, and I got run over by my heart. Now there's a roadside memorial to me in my heart. There it is. It's me and a memorial to me. That's what my heart is composed of. And sometimes I stop to read it, and sometimes I don't, and sometimes others do, and sometimes they don't. But my heart is now this place where there's me and a little memoriam to me and my death, because my heart ran me over. Now there's a roadside memorial to me in my heart that sees the good in people as they roadhog through my heart. So it's a hopeful note. I saw the good, I got ran over because I was there, and there's a memorial, and people now roadhog through my heart and look at the memorial, and that's going extinct, leaving thinking, getting rid of thinking, going out of thinked, going out of being thinked, being thinked, gone, away, exiting, thinked. So here it is, going extinct.
Right.
This has been the Inverse Theater Podcast, hosted by playwright Kirkwood Bromley. For more information, visit inversetheater.org.